Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, John Emmerich. Today we have Sam Tatum, author of Evolutionary Ideas, Unlocking Ancient Innovation to Solve Tomorrow's Challenges. Welcome to the New Books Network, Sam.
Thanks so much, John. It's great to be with you.
Sam, what is your background first, and what was the path that led you to this field and eventually this book?
Great question. So my background comes in organizational psychology. So I'm a trained organizational psych. It's one of those disciplines, if you go through a psychology path, there tends to be a bit of a fork in the road as you go to specialize. And on one half, it goes sort of clinical, where you're looking at all forensic, and you're looking at sort of abnormal behavior. And then there's another path that looks at more normative behavior. So I've always been more interested in sort of normal human interaction. That led me down an organizational psychology path. And that then, funnily enough, took me into advertising. So I worked in a role as what's known as a planner in advertising. So it's sort of a mislabeled role, I think, because it doesn't really have anything to do with planning or structure, but it's a strategy role. So I worked as a planner in Ogilvy. And then about 10 years ago, I was asked to bring my psychology more formally into our business, into our agency. And now I lead a global team of psychologists and behavioral economists in Ogilvy to help bring this burgeoning field of behavioral science, which is a sort of a broader banner category for behavioral economics, cognitive psychology, social psychology, a lot of different subfields, to draw upon this lens to help to solve some of the most interesting and problematic challenges that we face.
And just so people who might not be familiar understand, what does Ogilvy do? What is the nature of their business?
So Ogilvy is a big sort of multinational creative agency. So historically, we're most famous as an advertising firm, but we obviously have a lot of work in PR, in experience design, and our part of the business works within the consulting unit. So we're technically consultants within Ogilvy, which is sort of a big creative network.
Okay. And you use these tools every day in your job that we read about in the book, or nearly every day?
That's right. This might be a story of half of the tools that we use, more of the universalities, if we can find them within us. And another half of the tools is now looking at individual differences and cultural differences. So I think there's benefits in looking at both sides of the spectrum. And I talk a bit in the book as to the direction that I've taken for evolutionary ideas and why I think it's certainly beneficial. But I'd suggest this is sort of one of two lenses that are really important to bring to our challenges.
Okay. And those challenges that you outline in the book, reinforce trust, aid decision-making, trigger action, boost loyalty, and improve experiences. And there's a big element of innovation in this story and use Google Glass as an example of an innovation that didn't sell, at least not at retail. Do you and your group get involved in the product development phase before that product is ready to be sold?
Absolutely. So there are times we've worked with Silicon Valley firms launching hardware and asking the exact same questions about reinforcing trust. How can a big social media network encourage you to be comfortable having a camera and a microphone in your kitchen? What are the signals and cues that we need to embed within a process to enable that? And what I think is really fortunate, this really stems from working in any creative organization, is the smorgasbord of challenges that you're faced with. And I'm fortunate to be able to work in, as I said, in product design or experience design, all the way through to working with the likes of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in Nigeria and Indonesia to increase the consumption frequency of fortified products. So it's sort of, if it has people at its heart, then there tends to be a way in which we can apply this thinking. So it's a wonderful role.
I appreciate that. And I want to talk about, before we go more into the book, this double meaning to your use of the word evolutionary in the title. First, in the literal sense, which fascinated me, and we talked about it before we hit record, kind of a reference to evolutionary biology and how these ideas, these behavioral traits happened in nature, just as in the field of biomimicry, where I love the concept that these ideas have survived billions of years of testing. And if they didn't work, they wouldn't have survived. But you also use evolutionary to call out that this is about small changes or adaptations that can also have big impacts. And it's those kind of innovations, incremental in nature, that I think you're focused on. What's the significance, I guess, is the question of calling out the evolutionary nature of small changes versus the revolutionary?
Good, great, great question. And that's really the, if there was an enemy, and that's too strong a term, I think. But if there was a counter to this book, it's about revolutionary innovation. And an assumption that we all have at many stages, that we need to sort of conjure magic up from our pencil, that we need to come as the knighted shining armor and search the blue sky for a solution that no one's ever found before. And we have a real tendency to do this when we're faced with a challenge. We have a tendency to assume we need something magnificent and novel and big, particularly when we're faced with big or novel challenges. And I write a bit at the introduction of the book to decouple, like, what is this fascination with the revolutionary? Why are we always drawn to what are actually sort of low probability, high risk, high expense avenues to innovate? And why do we fall down this trap? And one specific lens is this inclination of, it's known as the proportionality bias. We have a tendency to assume that large outcomes require large inputs. In the physical world, it kind of makes sense, right? You listen to a loud bang and you assume someone must have hit that hard. When you drop a plate, it smashes. Your energy sort of distributes in that way. But when it comes to psychology and innovation, it can be very different. So actually, you can have big outcomes with small inputs. You can change our long-term health by making small adaptive changes. You can increase your financial well-being by looking at small changes. It doesn't always need to have a sort of a big problem, doesn't always need a big solution. But actually, what I focus on more so, because there's a lot written in the literature on innovation, certainly on the role of behavioral science in small changes making big differences. Where I sort of focus more so in evolutionary ideas is that sort of novel problems don't necessarily need novel solutions. Just because it might feel new to you doesn't necessarily mean that someone somewhere hasn't already solved it before, just in a place you never thought to look.
And that leads to Altshuler's TRIZ, the theory of inventive problem solving, which to me was like the systematic way of thinking creatively about engineering and design. And then you get to the three elements of inventive problem solving that I just want to touch on briefly.
Yeah.
First, that, as you said, the problem has been solved before. It may not be unique. The answer's out there somewhere. And that's true in the physical world as well as the psychological world we're going into. And the second one, I just had a question about this. There's a consistent pattern of solutions, beforehand cushioning. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so beforehand cushioning is an example of an inventive principle in the TRIZ methodology. So just to take us a step up, so the TRIZ methodology was developed by a Russian engineer who actually with himself and colleagues assessed around 200,000 patents and really identified, when I go back to this sort of rosy perspective of revolutionary innovation, they found actually between sort of 1 and 5% of patents that they observed was actually sort of genuine innovation. The rest of the patents were really solving challenges that had already been solved in other categories, coming up with the same idea. So what they did, I mean, that's sort of a realization. But what the TRIZ methodology does is it looks at patterns in technical solutions. So just if you imagine in biology, we look at species, different species of animal based on different features, the presence of a spinal cord or gills or different sizes and shapes of beaks helps us to identify different species. In TRIZ, they do this with technical or engineering solutions. So beforehand cushioning is an example of technical solutions. It's sort of a collective. It's like a species of solutions. So having a life jacket under your seat is beforehand cushioning. It's sort of preventing disaster in advance. Having tires around the road of an F1 track is beforehand cushioning. Having an airbag in a vehicle is beforehand cushioning. So it helps to sort of look at what's the role of this engineering solution and finds this pattern so we can build a sort of a collective nature of them, I suppose.
Fascinating. And Altshuler brought that all together and systematized it and organized it so you could actually use it as a research database.
That's right. So there are 40 different inventive principles. So you've got beforehand cushioning, which I've spoken to. You've got another example of segmentation. You imagine sort of the difference between having curtains or having Venetian blinds. They're sort of segmented curtains, or modular right. furniture versus a big couch. That sort of segmentation. So there are 40 different species or patterns of technical solutions that they've identified. And what gets really interesting, and John, stop me if we're going to sort of go here in conversation, but where Altshuler and why I've found TRIZ to be such a valuable model for the book is that what Altshuler found is the key to innovation, or his sort of perspective on innovation, is the resolution of a contradiction. So to go back again a little bit higher, so Altshuler was as I said a young Russian engineer, and actually he, after his observation of looking at patents, he actually sent Stalin a letter basically saying that I've witnessed all these challenges with the Russian Navy's approach to innovation. I have a better solution here. And that went down about as well as you might expect, and he was sent to labor camp.
Right.
But while he was in labor camp, he was essentially tortured. He was kept awake all night and prevented from sleeping during the day. And he's sort of faced with this impossible conundrum of how can I stay awake but get my sleep? How can I keep my eyes open but have them closed fundamentally at the same time? And it sounds like a sort of an impossible contradiction. But what Altshuler did with his prison cellmate was fashion eyeballs out of a cigarette packet and char on these pupils that his cellmate stuck to his closed eyelids. So as the guards walked past, he looked like he was awake, but he was fundamentally sleeping. So they were able to sort of resolve this contradiction, and that was innovation. And that's a really important term when we look at TRIZ, because actually the winner, I think, of TRIZ is a matrix that they've developed that looks at different contradictions that we might see in the physical world or in technology. So how might I make a bulletproof jacket heavy enough to stop a bullet but light enough to wear? I mean, that sounds like an impossible contradiction without innovation to help us to solve it. How do I make an umbrella big enough to cover the human body but small enough to put in a handbag? That requires innovation. So to help us to solve those contradictions, we lean on the inventive principles like beforehand cushioning, or like segmentation, or like the concept of a classic Russian nested doll that might help us to redesign an umbrella. So it helps us to say, well, this is the problem that we're faced with, and here's the inventive principle that we should start with.
And so right on cue, that was the third element of inventive problem solving, the solving contradictions. And that explanation actually helps me understand why it's so important to the story, because you're still making evolutionary changes, but when you're solving a contradiction like that, the impacts are actually huge.
They can be transformative. And that's right. That's where it's, so it's, while there might be adaptive problem solving that gets us to these solutions, sort of increments, once you can see it, then you can put it in an entirely different frame of reference. And what that helps us to do is change the category that we're in. So we're no longer in the umbrella business. So we're looking at our competitive set of other umbrellas. We're in the how do we make something big yet small business. And if you're in that business, you can look at NASA. You can look at so many other different categories that have solved this challenge of increasing the volume or the length of something without changing its fundamental size. So we can learn faster.
Perfect. And I could ask you questions for an hour about TRIZ, but that's all just a setup for what the book is really about, the corollary to the psychological world, biomimicry of the mind, where there's an opportunity to systematize creative thinking as well, based on human behavior as opposed to physical attributes. So that's the transition. Do I have that pretty much right?
But that's right. So if we look at the analogy that we form between the engineering or the technical world and the psychological, we also now today, through the burgeoning field of behavioral science, we have a new categorization of patterns of human behavior. So if we look at the stepping stones that we explore in the book, that there are patterns of biological solutions, like the presence of a spinal cord or gills or different beaks that helps us define the world of biology. We have TRIZ that helps us to see this in engineering solutions with inventive principles. And then if we look at behavioral science, which is where the book comes to life, the work of government and academia to identify these patterns in human problem solving and put a label on them. I know it sounds small, labeling these things. But having identified, just like we've got beforehand cushioning, now we can say, here are a suite of solutions that are social norms, or here are a suite of solutions that trigger our scarcity heuristic, or here are a suite of solutions that tap into operational transparency. And once we know what we're looking at, then we can more readily apply it. And that's what gets exciting, I think.
Right. And that our evolved perceptions heavily influenced by expectations and our previous experiences and the way information is presented. And I don't want to misuse the word contradictions because it's so important to your story, but I'm wrestling with a couple contradictions of my own in reading the book, and I'll get the first out of the way now. All of these biases and heuristics or shortcuts that I've read about through Kahneman and Thaler and David McRaney, it's fascinating to read that they actually have an evolutionary explanation in your book. But in all those other books and studies about these biases, the consistent theme is they're writing about them because they lead humans to make the wrong decisions, right? Thus our irrational brains and in behavioral economics, the irrational man or irrational investor. Why did these biases become ingrained through evolution if they're flawed? Did the need to make a quick decision trump the benefit of making a better decision? Why were they, quote unquote, successful as evolutionary traits?
I think your hypothesis is right. I mean, in many different instances, having the best solution might take more time than required to have a good enough solution that keeps us alive. And if you imagine a bit like the fact that we experience goosebumps and get the hiccups, that are biological lags from when we were covered in hair, that help us to sort of propel the cold, right? We still get the goosebumps, and that's a biological lag, and we have a psychological lag. So all of these and the language of irrationalities, and Dan Ariely wrote a fantastic book, Predictably Irrational, and that language can sometimes make us feel that we're faulty or we're broken. But I think what's most important is that much of our behavior, interestingly, goes against what could be seen as a classical rational economic model. And when you look at why this might be the case, so say, for example, having a discounted rate in the future. So you can buy it for $10 now, but you can buy it for $8 in 2 weeks' time. And we have a tendency to say, I'll just buy it now. You're in, or we have sort of temporal discounting that we can have a larger reward in the future, but we'll take a smaller immediate reward. And that in a world that we can save, in a world that we have freezers and fridges and credit cards, that we can start to think about the future. But in where we evolve these heuristics and shortcuts, it was like, if I don't eat this now, it's right. not going to be around tomorrow.
It's not going to matter.
So all of these things that might be seen as deficiencies within a modern day context were actually critical to how we got here. So I think we need to look at some of these insights more favorably. I mean, it's yes, they trip us up, and it's important that we understand this so we can build a world or build systems to help us to make the right decisions. But they're not because we're broken. It's because we've been highly effective problem solvers for a millennia. And if we understand why they've worked, then we can begin to replicate their successes, or at least, again, see this pattern and extrapolate that elsewhere. And this is where, just to sort of close on this thought, because there are two different worlds here a little bit that I've not expressed or tackled head on in the book, actually, around sort of biases that are sort of fallibilities. We spoke before about sort of the confirmation bias. Offline, we were talking about confirmation bias, that we have a tendency to confirm our own beliefs. We were saying, John, that we sort of listen to a radio station to hear what we want right. to hear rather than right. challenge. And that's a part of human nature, but it's not so helpful for innovation necessarily. It's helpful for us to know that it's a problem to address. I mean, it's a contradiction that we might need to solve, but it doesn't help us as a tool. But what I explore in evolutionary ideas are these patterns of solutions that have evolved that we can see. So what are we actually doing instinctively or through social learning or often by design, but we don't really know why it works, that now we can say, well, this works because it's an example of an X. And you can, by looking at the world that way, you can connect solutions across categories that we otherwise wouldn't have drawn together.
Right. And that's a great transition to getting into the book itself. And if you could talk about, explain the concept of the psychological principles using, I chose social proof as yep. maybe something, because I just think it's one that's be readily accessible to most listeners.
Yeah. So if you think of the going through the stepping stones, if we think of sort of Trizz's inventive principles like beforehand cushioning, so if you want to prevent disaster in the future, let's think about predicting that in advance and build for it. We have sort of psychological inventive principles, or what I just refer to as psychological principles, and social norming is one of those. And we can look at social norming, which is our tendency to follow the crowd. Again, if we look evolutionary, it sort of makes sense for us to do what other alive people are doing. Like, if we continue to copy what living people do, then we're probably more likely to continue living ourselves.
Right. And so
there is a bias, there's a heuristic there, this shortcut that we tend to do that. But we can also then see how commerce and business and design have tapped into this element of our psychology to persuade and inform behavior. So if you look at restaurants, sort of always pack their restaurants from the front windows back. You mean, so you're walking past on the road, they look really busy. That's a lovely social norming solution, that they've tried to make a restaurant look busy by making all their customers most evident. And in the book, I explore, so for social norming, a couple of different ways in on this. So one is adding things to our environment. Right? So how might we see things being added into a behavioral context that shows us that someone has been there before safely. And we can explore this back to Native American Indian tribes that used to bend over saplings to form marker trees. So the trees would grow as arrows and street signs, essentially, to say, this is where a safe crossing is. Safe way home. So even like, we can start to put things in the environment to show that this is a trusted or safe response. This is normed, all the way through to modern day social norming of a like or a testimonial. And we can start to say, okay, so this is, so a marker tree isn't so far away from a 5-star review if you know that both of them are right. looking at social proof. So that's sort of putting things into the behavioral context. We can also explore social proof from taking things away. to show that, well, someone's been here safely before. And that's, if you look at an empty cookie jar, you have a sense that they must be good cookies. So sometimes there are sort of patterns of solutions that is the absence of something that you're expecting to see that shows that someone has been there before. So a rip tag flyer for guitar lessons is a lovely example. If you see those sort of often on telegraph poles, and the best strategy to do is if you're ever putting one up, rip off half of them, because it makes it look like five other people have been interested before you. And it's not because you've put something up there, it's because you took it away.
Interesting.
So having this concept of social proof or social norm helps us to see all these disparate evolved solutions around us and connect the dots.
And social proof's a good launch point to talk about the contradictions again. The first contradiction is reinforcing trust without altering the truth. One psychological principle associated with resolving this contradiction is signaling, which I chose to ask about, not just because I think it's accessible, but because I can kind of see the roots in natural selection strategies to help detect dishonest signals. How might signaling play out in the real world or be used in your work?
Yeah, so signaling is a fascinating area. And if we start in biological signaling, signaling is important when there's what academia would call an asymmetry in information. So someone knows more than the other party. So right. how can we signal that? And we see this in nature, for example, in the poison arrow frog. I mean, it's bright, blazoned sort of disregard for its safety being bright yellow, sort of says, I'm so toxic, I can afford to be bloody obvious.
Right, you know I'm not afraid.
I'm not afraid. What's known as the stot of a springbok. I mean, if you ever see those sort of gazelles jumping on 4 feet, it's like a signal that I'm so young and fit and fast, don't even bother chasing me. But what's really important in signaling is that it's the cost of the signal that is related to its honesty. So if a poison arrow frog was actually delicious, it would just be walking around with eat me. Because of the cost to the frog is that it's seen more evidently. So if it was a dishonest signal, it's actually a really tasty frog, then it's doing itself an injustice. One bird eats a tasty frog and they say, you better have the yellow ones, they're delicious. Or an old springbok that's tired and knackered and it's got to pretend in front of the lions that, don't worry, I'm really young and fit, but it exhausts itself and then is picked off. So the cost of the action is really important to the degree of the honesty. So that's kind of the most important thing of signaling. And we can start to see this in our everyday work. So if we look at, there's an example I write in the book with Octopus Energy, a UK energy supplier. And just before Christmas last year, I think, they wrote out to potential customers and said, don't switch to Octopus. I mean, our research shows that it's far better for you to stay with your existing provider right now, and we'll come back when it's a better time to switch. And that was a cost to Octopus. I mean, they could have said, switch now.
Right.
But actually, the cost to Octopus reinforces the fact that they don't have a short-term agenda here. They have a long-term agenda. You don't buy spend 2 months' salary on an engagement ring to up and leave the next day. I mean, there's an investment in there that shows that you'll continue with that relationship. So that's a little bit about signaling, if that feels sort of linear enough, that signaling can help us to reduce what's known as asymmetry in information, when someone knows a lot and someone knows nothing. But a signal is only valuable if it costs you something. It's like a purpose is only valuable if you're invested within it. And if you can show the sacrifice or the cost within the signal, we can help to reinforce the perceptions of trust that come from it.
And is this related to this concept of reputational cost that you bring up? How does that figure?
So reputational is another element of the cost to the signaler. So again, if when you look at most powerful signals, they're not one-to-one, they're one-to-many. I mean, the coloration of the poison arrow frog is like everyone can see that. So the cost to reputation is essentially if there was a risk that someone would say, That's bullshit, Frog. I know you're delicious. then your cover's blown. Your cover's blown. Right. If there's a risk of just one bird that tried it one time said, no, you're delicious. And then it's, you risk it. So what we actually can see is that oftentimes digital brands with big digital footprints like Google or Facebook or Uber tend to merge into traditional media when looking to communicate important things like safety or trust, because it shows if Uber does an ad that makes this claim and it's on the Super Bowl, right? We know millions of people are seeing this. So if someone doesn't agree with this, or if someone says that's not the same as my experience, then that's an increased reputational cost. They'll say this is bogus, this is wrong. Whereas if it's one-to-one, if Uber's just telling me this on a personalized banner, then it's very hard for me to, unless I've had that experience myself, there's no what would be a good term? There's no community effect to call that's a mistruth. So the looking at reputational cost as a part of the signal is important.
And that notion that a more public broadcast could actually be better than the signal from a targeted ad to just one viewer, I found fascinating. I remember, 25 years ago, a book came out, one-to-one marketing. That's what it was all about, was, hey, John, I designed this just for you, but, how do I know you're telling the truth to just me,
And that's right. And I think there's a time and a place for that. But when we're looking specifically around trustworthiness, I mean, it's no surprise that most scams occur via email. I mean, you don't see many scams that are at 30 seconds. Exactly, on a billboard, because someone's like, don't call that guy, you're in, because it's public enough to have an increased reputational cost. So there's a couple of different ways of thinking about signaling in sort of the cost to utility. So it's been I've made this decision at great expense, you're in. And so I'm good for it, you know, because if it goes wrong, then I'm out.
Right.
All the way through to reputational costs, that actually, if I was lying to you, I would be found out pretty quickly, because this message is public enough. You know, the start of the Springbok is for everyone to see, not just a private dance for the lion.
Right. And within this first contradiction, you speak to, again, signaling and social proof plus operational transparency and labor illusion, which leads me to another question. Just as I was reading, in your work, do you often combine principles in your recommendations to clients, or does that tend to muddy the message? Social proof shows up here and again in the section on defaults, and I just wondered how often you can use multiple principles to solve problems.
Yeah, I think it's a really, really good question. And what's important with all of this stuff is it's not black and white. I mean, so there are areas of gray, and there are things that can be operational transparency. But if you look at it another way, you could see it as this. And in evolutionary theory, some of the best solutions have multiple roles. The leftover crumbs of the cookie jar not only says that they must be good cookies, it triggers the scarcity driver. Say, well, next time they fill the jar, I better get in quick. So it kind of does two roles. So the first thing to notice, it's not as clean as that. But to answer the question, I think to take us a step back then is to how we generate solutions from this theory. So in the book, I write a lot about, and we've spoken about TRIZ, about sort of systematic innovation, and I write a lot about systematic creativity and how we sort of extract the sword from the stone with this stuff, because the theory is helpful and always interesting. But what do we do with it? And for me, I'm a big believer in the power of questions. So I mentioned at the very beginning that I had a background in advertising strategy. And in advertising strategy, oftentimes you leave a creative team with like one line. You could be working for weeks on a brief and it distills itself down into one line that the creative team are going to be thinking about for the next month. Okay. But this point of provocation. So don't ask someone to say, ouch, prick them with a pin. What's the thing that's going to help to take them to somewhere that they wouldn't otherwise? And for me, with a lot of this work, it's about questions. So if we go back to social norming, and we look at I spoke to two different sides of the coin and social norm, things that can be left in a context and things that can be taken away. So if we were to look at that as a question, we might ask, what can we put in this context to show that someone has been there safely before? Or how might we enable user interaction to show that it's a trusted or safe experience? Or how might we make it open source to allow people to leave a comment or share their view? So those are three sort of questions that stem from that side of social norm. If we were to look at what might be taken away, we might say, how might we remove something from the context to show that someone's been there safely before? What are people expecting to see but isn't there that might show that this is already a familiar route for others? And in the book, for each section, I write a series of innovation questions, and that helps us to basically generate ideas. And then you have ideas. Then you have, well, we could do this or we could do that. And sometimes they merge together to say, well, actually, this single idea does a bit of social norming, but it also taps into our scarcity. It sort of almost is less important at that end. It's more about making sure that we've exhausted all of our avenues in ideating to make sure that nothing's left off the table. If that makes sense, John.
It does, and I'll just say that those three questions you put at the end of every chapter, coming from someone that was generally trying to learn something that was a little new, a little bit of a stretch for me, were brilliant. They really helped. I got a lot out of that.
I found just on that, I mean, as I said at the beginning, I work in what I think is a wonderful creative network, and I found over the years that it doesn't pay to turn up in a room or a workshop and just tell people how smart you are with theory. You mean, if you can convert that theory into a provocation or a question that anyone can answer, then you democratize this stuff. People don't need to know really that's operational transparency. They just need to be able to answer the question, how might we help people to see the working that's occurring behind the scenes? Right? If you can answer that question with an idea, then you'll naturally tap into operational transparency. So you can sort of cut out the middleman a little bit with these questions.
Yeah, I've not been a teacher in a long time, but I do coach youth sports. And I call it understanding the why. You don't tell the player just to go from here to here. Explain to them why, and then they'll actually remember it and start doing it on their own. Yeah. The next contradiction is aiding decisions without limiting choice. And I'm particularly struck by the first story introducing the paradox of choice involving retirement savings plans. Part of my work is helping people make choices in their retirement plan. And the plans I've seen are appalling to me. Plenty of bad options, too few good options, too many overall, and no way for a non-financial person to figure out which is which, so they punt. Can you just talk a little bit about the paradox of choice, and then I have a follow-up?
Of course. So we sort of tend to assume that more is more. I mean, no one wants to – you don't take the family out for ice cream and look at the three options. You want to have sort of a smorgasbord.
57 flavors, right? That's a brand. Right? Yeah.
And we feel if we've got more choices, then we're more likely to find the desired outcome. We're more likely to find something that fits. But what's interesting is that research tells us actually the more choices that we have is the more likely we are to regret a decision, to delay a decision, to be less comfortable with the choice that we've made after the fact. So the paradox of choice is really that actually some more isn't necessarily more. And having fewer better options or designing the choice architecture in a way to help limit choice can be more valuable than just offering up people more. So when we look at the retirement savings study, and I can't remember the statistics off my head, but I think it was for every incremental
option, 10 choices.
They sort of had a 2% reduction in people that actually went on to choose one. So there was a direct correlation between, well, the more options, the less people choose. So our job then becomes making sure that the choices are available. People have this flexibility, but we're able to present them in a way that's useful. We can architect the choice. We can make it helpful for people to navigate the solution that's best for them. And that's where the sort of the contradiction comes in. How do we aid decision making without limiting choice? So there are ways in which we can think around that.
And I'm going to get back to choice architecture in a second, but my follow-up on this topic comes out of the processed food world, where sadly I think it was Michael Pollan maybe that introduced the world to this consultant in upstate New York that came up with the Bliss Index through a large number of focus groups. It's the optimal amount of sugar, salt, and fat you can put in any product to maximize consumption. Is there a way to get an optimal number of choices that we, or I'm familiar with good, better, best. I'm sure there's science behind that. But is there an optimal number of choices? Does it change with every product or service? And is there a way to know when you've got it right?
Good question. I'd suspect that I don't have the answer, the absolute answer, but I think there would be different numbers for different categories. If you're looking at a mobile phone plan, you probably don't want 15 options, but if you go into a restaurant, you probably also don't want three.
Right.
So I think it probably likely depends on the category and expectations. But I think what's most important is we arm people with a reference to help them make a decision, so that there feels like there's clear differences between the choices that we're making. And so oftentimes the good, better, best model works. And there are ways in which you can then look to inform decision making, if you'd like. And this is where, mobile phone companies are expert at this, and I write a little bit about this in talking about decoys, where you make the sort of the where you decide which is the which might be the optimal solution for a patient, or what might be the most profitable solution for a company, and how can we drive people towards that. And a decoy is essentially having a choice that's of equal cost but less of value. For example, if we're looking at mobile phones and you've got one that's got good battery and a bad camera, and you've got one that's got a great camera but a bad battery, that's kind of a hard decision to make.
Right.
But if you have another one with a good camera but an even worse battery, that becomes the decoy for the one that's got a good camera and a sort of not great battery but better than the bad one. So you can throw sort of a sacrificial decoy to help people see what's good.
Yeah, you've got these overlapping kind of marginal cost benefit curves, and somewhere there's a spot that makes the most sense.
It's tricky. And for our listeners, so Dan Ariely, that we spoke about before, wrote, and I think it's Impredictably Irrational, around The Economist subscriptions, and looking at essentially people buying a newspaper or a physical
versus the online version.
Versus the online,
right?
And they basically, I can't quote the percentages, but if you have just got print only, then I think about 80% of people bought. Or if you've got digital only for more money, then a fewer number. But if you have digital plus print for the same price, then you totally change the market.
100%.
In the book I write, and the same thing is true in nature. So in one study, you look at gray jays, so a tiny bird, and you have two sultanas 20 centimeters away from you, and then three sultanas 50 centimeters away from you. And then you find that the majority of the time they go for the quicker two sultanas. But if you add three sultanas even further away, that becomes the decoy. So the birds shift now to the middle option more so than the first, because there's the same number of sultanas even further away than the second option. So we see this in nature, just as we see it in navigating mobile phone markets. And I go a bit deeper on asymmetric decoys now, just because it's an example of an evolved solution that helps us to make quick decisions. And I said, well, I don't know what's the perfect decision, but this is better than that option. So I'll do that.
Right.
And when we spoke before about a psychological lag and how these irrationalities sort of evolved, it's because actually sometimes making a quicker decision is better than a perfect decision. And these things help us to do that more often than not.
Right. And I'll cut this off if it feels redundant now, but it was about this topic of choice architecture. And another question of evolution with Thaler, Sunstein. You write early on that their brain's not a rational calculator, as every Thaler fan and student of behavioral economics knows. Survival of the species depends on responding quickly, correctly enough, most of the time. Those are my notes. I don't know if that's an exact quote, but I think the sentence speaks to this question about choice architecture, which definitely, I think, is designed to make people make better decisions, buy more broccoli than brownies, save for retirement, don't save for retirement, versus some of the tools in the book, which, again, are helping them make quicker decisions. Is there any tension there you can explain? Is they related to making better decisions easier? Am I making up a distinction without a difference?
I've not considered the difference, because if we look at things like save more tomorrow, that was sort of a defaulted option. So it sort of made the decision almost automatic. I think what's most important is that we don't assume the optimal decision. that we're not weighing up all the costs and benefits and pros and cons and then acting. We're trying to navigate what's good enough most of the time. And in the book, when we explore decision making, we do explore sort of defaults and defaulted options that just help decision ease way through to looking at having concrete terms and visuals behind things, just to sort of remove any degree of abstraction to help us decide more quickly. I've not considered the difference between sort of easier and faster. I suppose if it's easier, then it becomes implicitly a faster decision to make. What we're trying to do is remove the expectation of optimization and remove the cognitive load from individuals to help to inform choices in a way that we know the brain is more likely to respond to because of the way we've been built over
evolved.
Time.
Yeah, no, yeah. And you're dealing in the real world. That's the Achilles heel of all of modern financial theory, the academic piece, that we are what Thaler calls the econ, the perfect economic, who's processing thousands of data points and building spreadsheets to make a simple decision like I'm going to, you know, sell this stock. And it's just not reality as we're learning.
And sometimes these heuristics can be more beneficial than spending their time to run long calculations. So it's actually it's these times like hyperbolic discounting or temporal discounting that we forego a larger reward in the future for a smaller short term gain. And these are things that economists sort of hate. But if you understand why that made sense, actually it's kind of makes sense in our history. It just makes less sense now that we have the choice. So if we can most of the time these patterns of responses, these biases are really helpful for us. We don't even realize that it's happening to help us survive in a very dangerous, complex world. But by looking at by studies or looking at specific examples of modern society that trip us up. And I think it's been helpful. It's helped us to see this. There's something going here that we don't expect. But in the book, in Evolutionary Ideas, I don't go too deeply onto this sort of the fallibility. It's like, okay, we've understood that we've evolved a particular way. Let's best understand these patterns so we can help ourselves to innovate more effectively.
Yeah, and as humans, you do go into the book about why the psychological principle of defaults is so important, because our brain is just trying to deal with stimuli and data and inputs that it's almost inconceivable. And so there's a natural tendency to, oh, thank you for making my life easier. That's a good thing. I appreciate it, right?
Yeah. So many of your listeners would have come across the framing of system one and system two. That's an important foundation of a lot of behavioral science popularized by Daniel Kahneman. It's a sort of a simplification, but it's helpful if we think of system one being our sort of evolutionary old brain and system two being our sort of more evolutionary recent brain. But our system two is really expensive. This sort of more recent mushrooming of our brain, our frontal cortex, the part of our brain that can think about thinking, I mean, it costs a lot of glucose. So more often than not, we sort of tend to revert to our system one, and our system one is inherently lazy and it will just go with the flow of preset options. So when we start to think about, okay, so why are defaults so valuable? It's just because we don't have the processing power or our brains aren't. It would be impossible for us to make these decisions all the time in that way. So let's build a path that's built for our system one rather than our system two.
Got it. the book goes through imagery and chunking, and then we get to contradiction three, triggering action without forcing a response. And one psychological principle in particular, salient feedback. Again, because once I read about it, I could imagine some benefit in natural selection. But I'll let you explain the importance and power of feedback loops.
So feedback's really valuable for learning. I mean, so we get without having a sense of feedback, we never know if we're on path or not. And that can be in language, that can be in social learning. But if we look at speeding down a freeway, for example, or a highway, we sometimes find that we have less feedback. If you imagine the difference between driving through a sort of a tight alley in the city versus a freeway, where you've got in the tight alley, you've got people whizzing past you and houses and telegraph poles and all the good stuff. And in the freeway, you've got open road. It's very hard for us to know whether we've sped up or we're going over the speed limit. So we don't have that salient feedback that helps us to know to slow down. So salient feedback is really valuable in many different functions. And as a result, we've found in many brands or many companies where feedback is missing, that we need to bake it in there. And that can be a parent who's looking to change a diaper and doesn't know whether it's wet or not. So
changes colors.
So let's create a strip that changes color to provide a salient feedback that helps us to know that, just as having a sort of a radar speedometer helps us to know if we're driving over the speed limit. That helps us to know if we need to change a nappy. So there are these sort of lovely examples of feedback that help us to trigger us into action.
Those speed signs do work on me, I can tell you. Yeah. I have them all over our little mountain town. Contradiction four is boosting loyalty without increasing rewards. And I was shocked to learn that loyalty programs aren't that effective. They have a weak return on investment. How is that? They still seem so pervasive. Are there ways to make them work that are out there?
Well, still so. And when we look at and in the book, I reference some of the research from the Ehrenberg Institute in South Australia and Byron Sharp. And one of the hypotheses behind its ineffectiveness is they tend to work with existing customers. So you're not attracting new buyers and moving people into loyalty. You're just converting those who are buying your product anyway to buy it
for anyway, people. Right?
So I think if you look at frequency of purchase and consumption, even brands like Coca-Cola, I think, have such a long tail of consumers. I think about 4% of Coca-Cola's drinkers account for 25% of the volume. The other 96% are on this sort of really long tail. So essentially, one argument, school of thought, is that loyalty is extremely difficult, and it's a bit of a mythical beast for us to chase. The other is, if we can think about programs in a slightly different way, rather than just incentives, we can look at making the increases in loyalty that we desire without it costing the house, without having to have increase the dollar back on every purchase, or say, okay, we used to give a free coffee out for every 10, now let's give it out for every 5. There are ways in which we can bridge that gap using psychological levers, not necessarily commercial ones.
Okay. I necessarily skipped over so many of the psychological principles, and I cherry-picked the ones that I was intrigued by, and also thought, giving my outsider's perspective, what might relate to non-professional listeners. But are there any other principles or that you would like to tease for listeners before we wind down? Pick one or two, whatever you want to talk about.
I think the last what I really enjoyed, I think, researching for the book, is actually the last contradiction, which is about improving experiences without changing their duration. And to understand about experience, it's really important that we understand about time, and the difference between sort of the time that passes on a clock and the time that we experience passing. And they're two different things.
That was fascinating, by the way. Please, yeah.
And it was for me too. It wasn't an area of strength, but it was a really important area to explore in covering what I wanted to cover for the book. But when we look at all the classic things like time slows down when you feel like you're about to crash your car. You know, all these anecdotal feedbacks are starting to be proven in experimental paradigms that under stress, under situations of novelty, I mean, we really focus all of our attentional resources on the moment, and we take many, many more photos, for lack of a better term. We just capture every inch of that moment, so that time naturally feels longer. When we're in safe or familiar environments, our brain can afford to switch off again a little bit. We don't have to be thinking there's a saber-toothed tiger around the corner every time we put the bins out. And so by understanding at a physiological level, I suppose, what stretches or compresses time, then you can start to look at solutions that have evolved to improve our experience of weights or focus our attention on positives. We can start to see actually why they make a lot of sense. So I'll speak to one sort of specific concept within that around occupied time. It's the old sort of kitchen statement of sort of a watch pot never boils is a really lovely one. And again, we sort of tend to find that a lot of this theory exists intuitively. We just haven't had the science behind it.
Right.
And what's interesting, when we're unoccupied, we're bored. And if you think like you're bored, certainly for me, a couple of years ago, I would never have thought I'm really stressed. You know, but actually, when we're bored, we're stressed. You know, when we're in a high arousal state, and we're stressed, it makes the theory argues that it's a benefit for us to feel stressed when we're bored. It's an adaptive feature because it encourages us to do something else. If we're sitting there twiddling our thumbs, we're not out there looking to find our reproductive partner. We're not out there searching for cognitive or social stimulus that will help us in the future. So it's we're stressed to do something else. But when we're stressed, again, our attentional resources are focused and time feels longer. So when you're bored, it's like it's not just you're doing nothing. Actually, because you're stressed, time feels longer than it should. So once you understand that, it makes sense to know, well, just by occupying people, and it can just be like watching YouTube and tricking your brain into the fact that you're not bored, or if we look at Disneyland, extending the queue to make it feel like it's part of the ride. I mean, so you don't feel like it's a wait at all. These are really genius ways of converting unoccupied time into occupied time. The wonderful intro to that chapter, I say the wonderful intro, the anecdote that I appreciate that I wrote about is from a Times article, I think some time ago. It was about Houston Airport. And Houston Airport were experiencing lots of complaints for their arriving passengers. And the executive team got together and what they did is they found people were spending sort of 80% of their time just standing at the luggage carousel. So they improved the efficiency of the baggage handlers. I think they knocked about 8 minutes off the total waiting time, but the complaints continued. So the solution that actually worked, rather than sort of sanding down minute by minute based on sort of small incremental efficiencies, what they did was just ensure that the cargo bridge from the plane was at the opposite side of the airport to the carousel. So they made their customers or their passengers walk seven times further. But because you're walking, you're occupied, you're doing something.
Right.
So by actually getting people to walk further, they reduce complaints because it converted unoccupied time into occupied time. And if you think of that back into sort of the evolutionary underpinnings of this, we're probably more likely to bump into the love of our life walking to the carousel than maybe we are standing blankly at it. And it's right. It's a lovely way of thinking. It can be so simple to think about the psychological solution to this rather than an engineering solution, rather than spending more money, getting more baggage handlers, rather than sort of increasing the horsepower of the engines that get the luggage from the airport to from the plane to the carousel. So just get people to walk further. And that's what I love about this stuff, is it gives you permission to think slightly differently. It gives you permission to borrow from Houston, to borrow from Disney, to borrow from a McDonald's ATM sort of receipt when you're experiencing a meal. All these different worlds can come together once you know what you're looking for. And the codification of behavioral science has given us that. And by asking better questions of our problems, we're able to redistribute their value ourselves.
Yeah, this topic, the application that jumps out right away is what you talked about, just dealing with queues, whether it's the airport or the coffee shop. And it leads to your next book, I see, Sam, which is applying this not just to engineering solutions or marketing solutions, but business processes, right? The way things are structured.
I think if we can identify a contradiction that we need to solve, and that's if we look at the analogy of TRIZ, I think they identified about 1,500 different parameters and distilled those down into 39 parameters. I mean, we explored five different areas in evolutionary ideas, but there are many more nuanced ways in which we can think about this and build a process for not a perfect science. It's behavioral science. It's not perfect science. But by thinking about problem solving in a more structured, systematic way, drawing upon evolved psychological solutions rather than firstly assuming that we can conjure up magic from a blank page and starting from scratch, that actually there's an assumption that it exists somewhere and we can redeploy it. And it can be more efficient, more effective than costly rational engineering or technical solutions. And that's really what we're seeking here.
What you're after. You know, your story of the pain of boredom, there may be a multiplier effect. I just listened to an interview with Dan Gilbert at Harvard, where he talked about studies that showed that humans today just cannot be alone with their own thoughts.
Yeah.
Like they just, that's why that you said that the YouTube or social media, what does that do? But gives you a distraction. It shrinks time. It fills time. And it prevents you from having to be, you know, stuck in your own head, which we just have lost the ability to do, I think.
Totally. Be alone again. If we go back to what is the survival benefit of sitting there twiddling our thumbs, virtually nothing. If we can trick our brain to think that we're at a rock concert, you're in,
or doing something with our time.
Yeah, or we've turned into surgeons and we're currently on the set of House, you're in, then we're doing something beneficial. We're learning something. Then we're half the way there. I certainly find it helpful to understand why this might be the case. Why does time shrink or compress and stretch? And then what are the times that we want to stretch it? Because that's the other thing. We often talk about shrinking time. That's when we're talking about weights, but we're looking at extending time when it's really positive moments. The last sort of psychological principle that I explore in the book is about the peak end effect and how we tend to remember experiences based on their peak moment and how they end. You can start to think about designing really valuable, distinctive peak moments in a hotel stay or peak moments in a customer service that is designed to make it feel really long, to stretch that time. So we sort of just like an accordion, we can expand it and contract it based on what we're seeking to achieve. And this gets us some of the way to doing that.
That's fascinating. Sam, good books entertain, better books make you do some extra research on the side, which I've already started doing. I have two Dan Ariely books on my nightstand for 6 months, and great. I'm going to start reading them today. But the best books change the way you think and act, and I think this book hits the trifecta, and I can't thank you enough for your time today.
Oh, I really appreciate the time to speak, and thanks so much for reading, and I do hope your audience enjoys this discussion and the book.
I have no doubt they will. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks.